Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, The Times' David Sanger explains the Obama doctrine in foreign policy.
Olympic Games was an effort to try to develop a range of cyber weapons and cyber attacks that would go after the Natanz nuclear enrichment plant in Iran.
Columbia professor James Shapiro opens up the world of the Elizabethans.
You're talking about a huge metropolitan center, 200,000 people crammed within a very small area. Theaters, art, music, churches, bells pealing, people selling things on the streets. I think New Yorkers in particular would find themselves at home in Elizabethan London.
And Greg Coles has bestseller news. David Sanger is one of America's most respected foreign policy thinkers and analysts. He also happens to be the chief Washington correspondent for the New York Times. He has an important new book that's already arousing a great deal of interest. It's called Confront and Conceal: Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power. It's reviewed for us this week by Robert Mary, who says that it is a penetrating history of the president's effort to grapple with a world in flux. I'm delighted that David Sanger is joining us from Vermont, I believe, to talk about his book. Welcome, David.
Thanks, Sam. Great to be with you.
You know, just to get it out of the way, let's go through the real news you made with this book, which is about this remarkable cyber op that the Obama administration contrived and pulled off. Tell us about that.
Well, the program was called Olympic Games, and it actually started with the Bush administration and thus fits into that category of techniques that President Obama seized upon once he came into office, that President Bush had left him, and then doubled and tripled down on. And, of course, the drone program is probably the best known. Olympic Games was an effort to try to develop a range of cyber weapons and cyber attacks that would go after the Natanz nuclear enrichment plant in Iran. And this is the plant where Iran enriches most of its uranium. And, of course, it's been the focus of the concern that that enriched uranium could ultimately be used for bomb fuel, not for reactor fuel, as the Iranians have insisted. The program began around 2008, and in the days just before President Obama took office, President Bush invited him over to the White House and said to him, look, there are two critical covert programs you're going to want to hold on to, and one of them is drones and the other is Olympic Games. And it went swimmingly, Sam, for about 2 years as the U.S. and Israel, working together, stepped up attacks on Natanz until one day somebody made a programming mistake and the program itself leaked out of the plant and became what the world came to know as Stuxnet.
David, something you've already addressed here, it's a question that's arising during the campaign, and it's also in your subtitle. That is Obama's surprising use of American power. What's surprising about it?
Well, this is a book, Sam, really about the surprises. You'll remember that when President Obama came into office, really when he was campaigning in 2008, he talked a lot about engagement, engaging America's adversaries. And many of his opponents, including for the nomination, like Hillary Rodham Clinton, argued that it was naive to think that you could simply engage your adversaries the way he had in mind. His conservative opponents thought that he was weak and that a community organizer, as they often reminded voters about his past, could not be prepared to be commander-in-chief. So 3.5 years later, what's surprising about the Obama presidency? That he has used American power so aggressively and frequently so covertly. And he's really embraced three big elements of what he calls the light footprint strategy. That is a strategy of sending in either technology, drones or cyber, or special forces like the SEAL teams that took out Osama bin Laden, in hopes that they can go in quickly, do their work, and get out quickly, without sending 100,000 troops, without occupying a country, without spending hundreds of billions of dollars. And this works well in some areas. It seems to work well against groups of terrorists in a living room in the uncontrolled territories of Pakistan. It worked well for a while against Iranian centrifuges. It hasn't been much help in places like Syria or in conflicts like Afghanistan, because it doesn't help you rewire a society.
David, how did Obama arrive at what you call the Obama Doctrine? Is this something that he himself has devised? Is it done with advisors? I mean, how does someone like him, who, as you say, came into office without a great deal of foreign policy expertise, how does he evolve his own way of dealing with his very complicated outside world?
You know, as I was doing the reporting on this book, and the reporting took about 18 months, so I was reporting sort of simultaneously with the decision-making the president was making, what really struck me was the degree to which in year one, 2009, he came to change his view about how he would use American power. If you listen to him on Afghanistan, for example, in 2009, he started the year talking about building institutions in Afghanistan, sending girls to school, putting together a corruption-free program of governance throughout the country. By the end of the year, he had pretty well come to the conclusion that while he had approved a surge of troops, it was not likely to make a big difference in how Afghanistan is governed. And by 2010, he was putting together what became known as the Afghan Good Enough Committee, a committee inside the White House that had no publicity, no one talked about, that was basically devoted to diminishing America's goals, narrowing them and narrowing them and narrowing them again, so that he could get out, having claimed that the U.S. achieved some of its goals without really remaking the society. And I think that's the big transition for Barack Obama, that he came in with a great idealism about how American power could be used, and his pragmatic side took over very quickly when he discovered that, for example, executing the military's plan in Afghanistan would cost $1 trillion over 10 years, about what it would cost to insure every uninsured American.
Is there a small kitchen cabinet of advisors he particularly relies on and trusts?
There certainly is, both in domestic policy and in national security policy. In the national security arena, it starts with Dennis McDonough, the Deputy National Security Advisor, who's been with him since his Senate days, Tom Donilon, the National Security Advisor, who he grew increasingly dependent on and then promoted to the top national security post after he threw out General James Jones, who had been in that job for the first 18 months of the administration. It also includes Ben Rhodes, his speechwriter, national security speechwriter, but a young man who has also become an increasingly important policy player. These are the people who seem to make the decisions after the national security meeting is over, and after Secretary Clinton or Secretary Gates and now his successor, Secretary Panetta, have gone back to their offices elsewhere.
And how strong a role does Secretary of State Clinton play now?
I think that Secretary of State Clinton has played a critical role in many sets of issues and no role in some others. She won the early argument on Afghanistan with Secretary Gates in getting a surge together, but lost the later arguments as the president decided to speed the exit from Afghanistan. She warned the president against trying to undercut Hosni Mubarak, the president of Egypt, saying, look, Mubarak is no prince, and he certainly has been a terrible dictator and has run his country into the ground, but we don't know what's going to follow. Another military dictator, the Muslim Brotherhood. And I describe in the book how Secretary Clinton, when I went to go see her, basically said, you know, I told the president I thought everything would work out well, but it could take 25 years in Egypt. And that probably is going to stand pretty well. She has been most effective when she's been teamed up with the defense secretary, and I think that she had a very close partnership with Secretary Gates, less so with Leon Panetta.
David, let me ask you a question that I know our listeners must wonder about when they read an authoritative book like yours and hear you speak so knowledgeably in a program like this. How do you gain the confidence of these very powerful people at a time when they are actually making the decisions that will influence the course of history and their own role in it. Is there an understanding you reach with them about what you'll report, what not? Do you have to earn their trust through the work you do or through just relationships you establish with them?
You earn their trust by convincing them through your own writings that you're very serious about the topic that they take up, and that you are willing to hear them out, that you're willing to offer as an objective an evaluation of the success or failures of their policies as you can, and that you are read by others around the world because people become convinced that you're spending time to really learn your topic matter and that you're fair. And over time, I think that that helps build up the set of relationships you discuss. There are times when these relationships are strained. I can tell you that no one in the U.S. government was particularly happy to have the story of Olympic Games out, at least the ones I spoke with. But at the same time, I think they understood that the fact that the United States was conducting a sustained cyber war, the use of a new weapon against other nations, was something that couldn't stay secret forever. You hear a lot in an election year in Washington about political motivations of people trying to go make their president sound stronger and tougher and sitting in the Situation Room making hard calls. I'm sure that's true, and it's one reason that people talk. But the fact of the matter is, that's true no matter who's president. It was true when people would talk to us about why George Bush made the decisions he did in Iraq and Afghanistan and why Bill Clinton made the decisions he made in Bosnia.
David, let's circle back to the very first point you made when you described this sort of dramatic early meeting between Barack Obama and the outgoing president, George W. Bush. How does Bush's foreign policy look today? Is there any kind of revision or reevaluation going on?
If I had to summarize it, I would do it as follows. That a lot of the techniques that President Bush started up in his second term, including this increasing use of drones and cyber, but not exclusively that, including engagement with North Korea and increased sanctions against Iran, were things that President Obama found he could build upon, even if he didn't fully credit President Bush or gave him no credit at all. What that tells you is that there was a bigger difference between the first Bush term and the second Bush term than there is between the second Bush term and President Obama's term. Now, President Bush does not view it that way, and if you read his own memoirs, which came out about a year, year and a half ago, Decision Points, he really doesn't make a distinction between the kind of decisions he made in the first term and what he did in the second term. When you go into the memoirs of Dick Cheney or Condoleezza Rice, you discover they saw a very big difference. And I think that's probably the right interpretation.
David, one last question. We often hear that presidents, even if they campaign on domestic issues, find once they're in the White House that it's really foreign policy and national security questions that absorb them most and where they feel they can make the largest difference. Has that been the case for this president too?
Yes, I do think that President Obama has seized on foreign policy, and he's done so, I think, in large part because he lost Congress 2 years ago and discovered that there wasn't really a whole lot he could get done in the domestic agenda by himself. And I think that the kind of problems that he was facing in the foreign policy arena with Pakistan, with Israel, with Iran, certainly with the rise of China, were all areas where he thought that he could make a difference with his own team and ignore Congress. And in fact, he did. He did the entire Libya incursion and the bombing effort with NATO, basically ignoring Congress. He talked more to his allies about that than he talked to leaders in Congress. If he is elected for a second term, my bet is you're going to see even more of that, that you're going to see him move much more aggressively in the foreign field, because the chances that he would get a Democratic House and Senate are just about nil.
Well, it'll be very interesting to watch. Thanks so much, David.
Thank you, Sam.
That's David Sanger, whose new book, Confront and Conceal, Obama's Secret Wars and Surprising Use of American Power, is reviewed in this week's Book Review. A.N. Wilson can't stop himself. Book after book, many of them about British history, British literature. He has a new book called The Elizabethans. It's reviewed for us by the very distinguished Shakespeare scholar James Shapiro, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Jim.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, The Elizabethans. What does Wilson want us to know about them?
He wants us to know that this was a remarkable age, a creative age, an age of political and religious strife, and an age which is an example to our own.
And obviously we hear about Shakespeare. Who are some of the other figures? Queen Elizabeth herself?
She's looms large, as we name the age the Elizabethan age, as opposed to the Jacobean age for King James. She's there, her courtiers are there, the explorers are there, but he also digs a little deeper, and he gets to some of the great writers of the period who may not be as well known. Hakluyt, who wrote an extraordinary series of stories about travel without ever having left England's shores. John Stowe, the antiquarian historian of London, and others who helped for him shape English national identity.
And how did this happen? It was a great Renaissance. It's like ancient Athens or Florence or Boston in the great period in early American history. What were the forces that created this remarkable period?
They were mostly negative forces. Plague was one of the things that challenged this period and sobered it up, I guess. The Reformation and the change in religion where everybody's parents were Catholic and then suddenly the state veered wildly back and forth between Protestant and then Catholic again under Elizabeth's half-sister Mary and then Protestant again. So the sense of division and strife and obviously the changes that occurred with the Reformation with the English language and a far more literate public and the rise of the published book made literature extraordinary and made it possible for writers to earn a living for the first time in England.
Is that true? That's the first time ever.
Well, you could always have a patron and the patron would support you and or you'd have another sort of job and that would support you. This was a time where you could make money as a writer, as Shakespeare and Ben Jonson and others did. Not a lot, but enough to support yourself, which is probably more than we can say today for most writers.
And what was life in London like then? I mean, is this – would we recognize it as a city today?
I think we would. I think that London physically is gone, the Great Fire of 1666 and so much the German bombs in the Second World War have erased most of the traces of that. But you're talking about a huge metropolitan center, 200,000 people crammed within a very small area, theaters, art, music, churches, bells pealing, people selling things on the streets. I think New Yorkers in particular would find themselves at home in Elizabethan London.
So someone like Shakespeare, we don't know a great deal about him. You know as much as anyone does. How does someone like Wilson look at this broader panorama and tell us things we don't know? Or maybe does he tell us things we already know?
What he does best is pen portraits of great figures. He must have written now 15 biographies, so he can do many biographies. The book is called The Elizabethans. It's probably not the best title. It should have been My Favorite 20 Elizabethans. Mm. He captures their lives. When he strays a little too far afield and tries to speak of the collective experience, he gets into trouble.
Well, give us some examples. Your review
sure.
is quite pointed, and our listeners should hear.
I try to be as gracious and generous because it's a tough period to wrap your head around. And he's written about the Victorians, modern period. He has tremendous range.
I did a biography of Tolstoy that's actually quite good.
And he's probably written another biography between the time we started speaking and now, I suspect. He says, for instance, that the ideal age of marriage in Elizabethan England was 14.
And you mean that was the marrying age,
that
really?
That was the marrying age. And because we all see Romeo and Juliet, and he's seen it as well, and he cites that as his evidence. In fact, you can look at parish records, and they'll tell you the same thing across the land. On the average, people married at 24 or 25. Mm. A sixth didn't marry at all.
A sixth of them didn't marry at all.
That's right. And that's another way in which I think New Yorkers today or Americans today can relate to the Elizabethan experience. So this fantasy of everybody marrying young and the like is just not so. And people going to see Romeo and Juliet themselves would have spent perhaps 10 years from the age of sexual maturity to the time they actually got married, repressed, desiring for that kind of sexual lives that teenagers today perhaps might have, very low illegitimacy rates back then. So it tells you something about that culture, that it really insisted that people delay marriage until they had the finances in line. They lived on the average only till 45 or 50 or so you don't have a lot of silver wedding anniversaries. But when he starts making those kinds of claims based on the literature of the period, which he knows really well, he gets into trouble.
And how violent was life back then?
I would say enormously violent. Shakespeare was lucky, and his theater company was lucky, that no one in that company killed anybody else. Marlowe was violent. He died a violent death. Ben Jonson killed a man and bragged about it. He claimed his neck verse by reading a psalm in Latin that enabled you to prove to the authorities that you should be spared from your first manslaughter accusation or conviction. So it was a violent and a litigious society. Again, something that makes it familiar to our own.
Thanks so much, Jim.
My pleasure.
That's James Shapiro, who reviews The Elizabethans by A.N. Wilson in this week's book review. Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Sam. How you doing?
So, Greg, we've hit summer doldrums already?
We have. There's nothing new at all on the nonfiction side, where the top bestseller is still Cheryl Strayed's Wild. And over on the fiction side, where the number one title is still Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl, there are only three new titles this week. The top-ranking new book is Jennifer Weiner's The Next Best Thing at number two.
And Jennifer Weiner is a figure of some controversy and interest.
It's mostly controversy that she engenders, and I mean engenders. she weighs in a lot on discussions of women in publishing, women authors and their reception in the publishing world, especially here at the Times. She is one of a group of women who pay real attention to how we do at reviewing women authors, whether we use equal numbers of male and female critics. She especially has gone through a year's worth of the Times and looked at how many women have been reviewed both in the weekly Times, the book review section where we work, and in the daily Times, where the daily book critics for the arts section, how many women have been double reviewed, as she puts it, as well as getting a profile in the arts section. So she calls that the trifecta. It's as much love as you can give to a single author is to review their book twice and to give them a profile.
So she is an avid reader of the New York Times. Is that our bottom line here?
That's right. The numbers weren't good, although that mostly has to do with the profiles. They're heavily weighted toward male authors. It was something like 10 men had gotten all three and only one woman in the year that she looked at.
So 10 men had their most recent work reviewed in both the Daily Times and at the Book Review, and in addition to that had been the subject of a profile, and only one woman had?
It depends also how you define profile, because there were women who were the subject of articles, but maybe it wasn't really a personality profile. Anne Patchett during that time was profiled for opening a new bookstore, and that article appeared on page one.
Page one of the entire newspaper?
That's right. And so, but she didn't count that as an author profile because it was really a look at an author opening a bookstore. I would dispute that characterization. And also, in our own defense here, in the Book Review's defense, I would note that we have nothing to do with what books the arts section chooses to review or with what authors they choose to profile. We operate independently and make our own decisions about what books are worthwhile.
But she brings a kind of, what shall we say, Talmudic exactitude or precision to all these fine gradations of differences and coverage, and that's very important to her.
It is very important to her, yes. And she raises some serious issues. Her new book, The Next Best Thing, looks at some of these same issues in the TV world. You know, she writes very...
Be careful, Greg.
Very accessible fiction. She's certainly a popular novelist. Her books are frequently on the list. And she, in addition to being a novelist, also is the creator of the ABC sitcom State of Georgia. She was the showrunner during that show's run. Her new novel looks at a young woman trying to pitch a TV show, and it gets picked up, and it talks about the travails of trying to make a TV show.
I say double review this woman and profile her pronto.
We did recently do an interview with her in our Artsbeat blog. Does that count?
Well, we'd better ask Jennifer. Now, do we have another new book on the list?
We have two other new books on the list.
Let's hear about them.
At number four, the mystery writer Karen Slaughter has a new book called Criminal on the list. She is also a regular presence on the list. Each of her last six novels in a row have hit the hardcover fiction list. And she had books on the list before that, too. She writes very kind of violent, noirish mysteries.
So well, she's got the name for it.
It's actually the name she was born with, Karen Slaughter. She said she's entitled. She got teased enough as a child that, you know, now she's entitled to use her name on this kind of book. Those books are all set in Georgia, where she lives, where she was born and raised. And then finally, down at the bottom of the list at number 14, the author Chris Cleave has a new novel out, Gold, which is about a couple of sprint bicyclists who are competing to make it into the Olympics, friends and rivals in the cycling world.
We reviewed that book. In their specific Olympics, the current London Olympics?
Yes, in the 2012 Olympics, that's right.
You know, I think Proust was once considering writing a very long novel about the Olympics when it looked like they might be held in Paris that century, but then thought better of it.
Cleave, actually, he's a London novelist himself. His first novel was called Incendiary, and it came out the day of or the day after, right around the time of the July 7th, 2007 terrorist attacks in London, all the bombings on mass transit there. And Incendiary itself was about a terrorist plot in London. And so he got a lot of attention just because of the freakish coincidence of that timing. I mean, he followed it up with a book called Little Bee, also set largely in London, but about a 16-year-old Nigerian orphan who is taken in by a British couple. That book was a bestseller for a long time. And so this new book, it just looks like it's on its way as well.
Almost destined to do well. And probably prophetic, because I have a feeling there are some sprint cyclists who are friends and also rivals.
Is the word prophetic or reportorial?
Thank you, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.